I'm Zachary Miles. This is number 0403, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0403. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet PR expert Ryan McCormick, and he talks about how to deal with United Airlines' current PR nightmare.
Oust the CEO right away, has to go. He's become a focal point of a tremendous amount of negative attention. CEO has a tremendous amount of influence. He has to go right away. Very bad responses. Awful, awful responses. He's killed his credibility. He killed his credibility the moment he went out and he gave his ho-hum apology for Dr. Dow being dragged off that airplane and then sent an internal email that said, hey, great job, everyone. Credibility killer.
Stuart Nullman recounts a bit of the emotional BBYO March of the Living that took him to Poland and Israel.
Since I was like 10, 12 years old, I read up a lot about the Holocaust, read a lot of books, seen a lot of documentaries, seen the photos, the film footage, and you know what? That doesn't prepare you for, you know, when you see the concentration camp. And we visited four of them. Besides Auschwitz and Birkenau, we visited Majdanek, which was pretty well preserved after the Russians liberated it, and Treblinka, which was destroyed in almost like a graveyard, or like a cemetery. But nothing prepares you for what you're going to see up close and personal.
Nancy Three Hoffman, who runs the Umbrella Cover Museum in Maine.
I started asking other people if they didn't know what to do with their umbrella covers, and they would say, oh yeah, I have a few here in my house, do you want them? And I inadvertently kind of collected them until I realized I had something. And the something I have is really the stories behind the covers. So I asked people to tell me, what happened to the umbrella? Where were you when you bought this? Give me some anecdote or some little history behind the cover. So they all have their own stories as well.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0403 was 9-year-old Zachary Miles from Arizona. He's the son of Dan Miles, host of Every Friday with Dan and Olivia, and also the Friends of Dan podcast, two really, really great shows. By the way, however, clearly Dan is riding on the coattails of his 9-year-old son, so we will be calling Child Services. Thank you very much, Zachary, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported and fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Doctors at a Colombian hospital performed surgery on a woman who swallowed more than $7,000 in U.S. $100 bills during an argument with her husband. The 28-year-old woman told doctors that she was suffering from severe stomach pain after swallowing between $7,000 and $9,000 in U.S. $100 bills. The woman said she had raised the money by selling household electronics and had been planning to use it for a trip to Panama, but she swallowed the cash out of spite when her husband demanded a cut of the money during an argument. According to the chief of surgery, Dr. Juan Pablo Sereno, the patient was taken to surgery, two operations were performed at the gastric level, at the exit of the stomach, and at the disc part of the intestine. He said surgeons successfully removed $5,700 in bills that were in salvageable condition. The rest, which were palpated in the tract, were advanced into the colon and were expelled in the normal way, he said. Police said they are currently holding on to the $5,700 bills removed from the woman's stomach until investigators can verify she wasn't attempting to smuggle it illegally. Well, This brings new meaning to the term flushed with cash, doesn't it? I'm also guessing that whenever she goes on vacation, it won't be with her husband. And speaking of smuggling, customs officials in Arizona said a woman attempting to cross the border from Mexico disguised $45,000 worth of heroin as her buttocks.
I like big butts and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny. Now when a girl walks in with an itty-bitty waist and a round thing in your face, you get sprung.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection said the 47-year-old woman, a U.S. citizen from Arizona, was referred for further inspection when she attempted to cross the border from Mexico to Nogales in the pedestrian lane. The woman was searched, and investigators discovered she had nearly 3 pounds of heroin worth more than $45,000 strapped to her backside inside her pants.
Baby got back. Baby got back.
The woman and the seized drugs were turned over to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's Homeland Security investigations. Well, her freedom is behind her now.
Little in the middle, but she got much back.
A man walked into a Family Dollar store in Youngstown, Ohio, and handed the clerk a note. The clerk couldn't read the poor handwriting and handed the note back to the man, asking him to read it aloud, so he did. "This is a robbery. Please be quiet. Don't let your pride get you killed." The clerk gave the man money from the register and a pack of cigarettes. Police were able to identify 22-year-old Dion Taylor from the surveillance video. He was arrested and charged with the robbery. You know, with such bad handwriting, a career in medicine would have worked out better than a life of crime. Either that, or he just should have only tried to rob pharmacies. They can read anything. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, I think we have definitely reached a point where we are allowing technology to take over our own common sense and thought processes. You know, while calculators have made math calculations easier, they've also removed the ability in some people to know how to do calculations in their head or even on paper. Some people can't drive from A to B without a car navigational system, which they will blindly follow into a river or literally off a cliff. And I have actually met some people who, when they ask me the time and I say it's 10 to 2 or a quarter to 3, have no idea what I'm talking about because they don't understand analog time. Well, I've got a couple of new items here that are leading our lives down the rabbit hole of technology dependency. Number one, the Aqua Genie, subject to a current crowdfunding campaign, would be a $70 water bottle with Wi-Fi. Let me repeat that, a $70 water bottle with Wi-Fi. Fill the bottle and enter your water goals. The app will alert you to various courses of action if you've insufficiently hydrated yourself. Really? Has it come to this that you can't tell that you need more water? And number two, already on the market, a company called Black Sox has introduced Calf Sox Classic with Plus, a pair of socks with an internet connection. The smartphone app can help you color match your socks and tell you, among other things, whether it's time to wash them. Okay, I can see how someone who is colorblind might need help matching their socks, but if you need an app to tell you when to wash your socks, you have a whole other set of issues that you need to deal with. Seriously. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? United Airlines has been experiencing a tsunami of bad press in recent weeks. First came that cringe-worthy video of a man being dragged off a plane. Then the airline was listed dead last in a customer service ranking of U.S. airlines. To top off the bad PR, a new report claims United accounted for a third of animal deaths on U.S. flights in the last 5 years. Can bad PR destroy a business? Well, reputation management specialist Ryan McCormick says, yes. Ryan is the co-founder of Goldman McCormick PR, and he joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Peter. Great honor to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. And full disclosure, people might know we have a lot of great guests on this program and on my previous program several years ago, and you can't get great guests unless you have great PR firms that help you get some of these guests, and you have been supplying guests to our show for years, so thank you very much for that.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for being great to work with. So it's a real pleasure.
So getting to United Airlines, if you were the person in charge of PR, and I guess that would be drawing the short straw here in your case, what would you do to try and resuscitate their reputation, if it's at all possible to do?
Well, it's at this point, it seems that you have to go out. You have to come outside the company. I don't know if change can happen within the company at this point, because the main problem is that the CEO, and Albert Einstein once said, no problem can be solved with the same level of consciousness that created it. And the consciousness that was created, the problems that have been created, like, you contribute a lot of them to the CEO of United Airlines. And he has a lot of tone-deaf responses. So as the PR representation, I don't know if you could say, as an internal PR team, and say, listen, the CEO has to go and the CEO is signing your check. So I would probably be, I would probably want to be part of the board. Oust the CEO right away. Has to go. He's become the focal point of a tremendous amount of negative attention. The CEO has a tremendous amount of influence. He has to go right away. Mm. Very bad responses. Awful, awful responses. He's killed his credibility. He killed his credibility the moment he went out and he gave his ho-hum apology for Dr. Dow being dragged off that airplane, and then sent an internal email that said, hey, great job, everyone. Credibility killer.
Okay, well, as someone who is in PR, what are the steps that are taken? You mentioned the CEO giving a lackluster response about the doctor being dragged off. Is it the company's job or onus to go to their PR firm and say, look, we've got this big problem? I mean, obviously the PR firm would know it, whoever is doing their PR, be it in-house or outside. We've got this PR problem. What should our next step be? In other words, should they have someone in PR guide them before they say or do anything?
Yes, you should have. Yeah, absolutely. And they should have a team. A company that big should have an entire team or council to work with them to lead their responses. And you know, I think that a commonsensical approach to PR would be you have to let your customers know that this incident is intolerable. And this is something that's terrible. You're going to do everything you can in order to make the situation right, because your customers are the reason why you're in business. And if you look at United Airlines, it's not like this was something that they could brush aside. They lost $1 billion in the first or second week. And whether it was from this incident alone or other situations, a lot of people have tarnished. I mean, United Airlines has a horrible reputation right now. And the first thing you have to do is you have to make the situation right with your customers and with the media. And they are doing the exact opposite. I can't believe that they're still in business right now.
You have been in PR for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a more difficult job to help keep the reputation of a company afloat in this day and age of social media, where everybody has a camera, where everybody can respond to tweets, where everybody can add something to the end of a column or story that is negative in any way, shape, or form about a company or entity? Does that make your job more difficult, because bad press, unlike maybe a decade ago or two decades ago, doesn't seem to go away?
I think it does make it more difficult, but I have to say I think it makes it more challenging and more fun, because your PR team has to constantly be vigilant about all different aspects about what's going on, and you really need to stay on top of things. And I think it's very good. I think it keeps a lot of people on their toes. As if a company CEO is always being honest and they're doing everything they can in order to provide the best service possible, and people see that, no matter what happens, I think they're going to be okay. I mean, unless you have senior-level officers being caught on camera saying racial epithets. I think that's the killer there. I mean, there's one business I can think of, Peter, that absolutely died because of bad PR, and that was a company called Miracle Mattress based in Texas, who did this very despicable, tactless Twin Tower sale around 9/11, and their business actually shut down because of the vicious backlash. I don't think United is anywhere near there at this point, but all these companies that are out there, you know, if you're honest with the media, you're honest with your clients, and you do everything you can to serve your clients with excellence, I think you'll be okay, despite the fact that our world's moving at a million miles an hour.
Okay, so you've mentioned the mistakes that United has done. You've mentioned what they should have done immediately after the situation and how they could have rectified it. But as the saying goes, that ship has sailed. So what if they brought you on board now? What would you say to them to try and rehabilitate their reputation today after all they've done so badly up until this point?
Okay, well, first off, Oscar Munoz, the CEO, has to go. Have to get him out right away, top priority. Okay, next thing you have to do is highly recommend you purge all employees that work with the public who've had poor behavioral histories, who've had incidents where they've had questionable behavioral issues. If there's anything on there that would even imply that they could be a potential negative aspect of the company, get rid of them right away. They have to do it. All people that interact with the public are a representation of United Airlines. Like United Airlines should hire a new PR team. There are agencies that are out there that are very big. They could probably take on an agency like that. I think they should be wise to hire an agency that's not as big but is very passionate, because a team, an agency like that will do whatever it takes to provide a new perspective. They need a new insight on this, a new outlook. Lastly, customer service needs to be a top priority. They need to really go out of their way to treat their customers like gold. I fly JetBlue, and I love the way I am treated. They treat me like, you know, they treat me like I'm luxury. They give me these free headphones on the plane. Sometimes, and if the plane's landing, if it's going to be a little bit late, they provide extra service. So those little things are really fantastic. I recommended that they talk with the Marriott Corporation, because I feel that they are very cutting edge and innovators when it comes to excellent customer service. So I feel like United Airlines, all their executives, should spend about 2 weeks with the Marriott Corporation to really learn excellent customer service skills and retrain themselves.
Well, speaking of customer service and their competitors, I'm sure a lot of their competitors have felt that they may have dodged a bullet because, you know, as the saying goes, there but for the grace of God go I. Right now it's United that's in the crosshairs, but this could have happened to any other airline as well. A lot of the airlines have been, for lack of a better term, treating clients like cattle for a while, and United just seemed to be the one that got caught right now. How should the other airlines respond to this? And the reason why I say that, could they not be seen as piling on? For instance, I know Southwest had a great campaign talking about how they treat their customers better, but could there be a situation where that could backfire because they seem to be kicking a competitor when they're down?
Well, potentially, but if you're providing excellent customer service, you're going to rise above. You don't even need to attack United Airlines. If you just provide excellent customer service, you're going above and beyond. I mean, you're naturally going to stand out. And I think just by reminding the public to how you treat your customers is very, very helpful. I mean, if anything, this is actually taking the eyes off the TSA, because they sexually assault people before they got an airplane. So it's taking, the TSA is not even being talked about right now because of what's happening. You know, we had this other incident with the American Airlines where you actually had, you know, one of the people on employee threatened it to hit a mother with her child. So I don't know what it is about the industry, but all these other competing airlines, if they provide excellent customer service, if they're nice, if they're sincere, people will see that, and they don't even have to attack United. United is a ship that seems like it's sinking because they're responding to these situations very poorly. They should have never been in this position. And also, Peter, there was this incident where they had this rabbit, this large rabbit, it died on United Airlines. And the report that came out that said a lot of animals have died on United Airlines flights. That was another catastrophic disaster for United Airlines because they didn't address it right away. People don't ever want to fathom the idea of their beloved animals dying on an airplane. And that's another situation that came out. United responded very poorly. This situation, the way it is right now, should have never gotten to this point had they responded more effectively.
Okay, very quickly, one final question, and that is, airlines, like you say, that have a good customer relationship, would it be good PR on their part to come out with, like you mentioned, JetBlue? Should JetBlue come out with the JetBlue Passenger Manifesto, saying this is how we treat our passengers and why, and what we pledge to do? Would that be a good thing to do at this point?
I think it'd be a great thing to do. I think it would be a great thing to do for all competing airlines to talk about how their airlines are different, all the perks. Yes, remind people what excellent customer service is. I stay in certain hotels, and I fly certain airlines, and I take certain cars because of the quality of how I'm treated as a customer. And when you know that the place you're doing business with cares so much about you, just the same way our clients work with us because they know we care about them a lot, people tend to go with the airline or with the company that cares about them the most. And United Airlines has clearly shown that customer service is not a priority, and any other airline that makes customer service a priority, they will grow substantially, and I think that they'll definitely rise and grow their business.
Ryan, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Peter, it was a great honor. To learn more about our company, go to our website at goldmanmccormick.com.
That's www.goldmanmccormick.com. Thank you very much, Ryan.
Peter, it was a great honor. Thank you.
Ryan McCormick, co-founder of Goldman McCormick PR. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0403, and you'll find links to Ryan's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Stuart Nullman, but not about books. This time we talk about the BBYO March of the Living. Plus, Nancy Three Hoffman, a woman who runs an umbrella cover museum. Just the covers. Just the covers. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on here on a program that is also listener-supported, fan-funded radio, and depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, an Indian River County, Florida sheriff's deputy stopped to do a welfare check on two people under a blanket near a house. As he approached, a woman popped out from under the blanket, yelling that, "I am part of the Illuminati and Freemasons. You have no authority and I do not have to leave." They weren't there to tell her to leave. They were just trying to make sure she was okay. But she continued to yell and rant that she was a famous music talent and she knew judges and her family would have my job, the deputy noted in his report. Then the man under the blanket popped up to join her. He continued to yell along with the female about Freemasons and their impending music record deal and the celebrities, judges, and power their family had. All the yelling brought people out of their houses to see what was going on. That was evidence that the peace and quiet of their neighborhood was being disturbed. So, the deputy arrested 37-year-old Kristen Morrow and 25-year-old George Major Davis for disorderly conduct and took them to jail. Here's a great life rule, folks. Those who claim they're part of the Illuminati aren't. Just to let you know that, okay? Anyway. Kenneth Deinst and his brother Gary Deinst and Justin Wiles were hunting turkeys in southeast Kansas. Now, Kenneth split off from the other two to hunt using a technique called fanning, where the hunter uses the preserved tail fan of a wild turkey along with turkey calls to attract or sneak up on a targeted turkey. Okay, you already know where this is going, don't you? According to Kenneth, he saw a strutting turkey and used the technique to get closer and to fire. Now, according to Kansas Department of Wildlife, Parks, and Tourism game warden Jim Busone, right after he shot, he thought he saw a turkey flopping on the ground. But when he hurried up there, he saw two guys rolling on the ground. He'd shot his brother Gary and Wiles in the face. The two men had also been fanning. They were calling each other and sneaking up on each other like two Toms coming at each other, Busone said, noting the two men were hospitalized and should survive. Busone goes on to say, both swore they were sneaking up on real turkeys. Well, when you think about it, they kind of were. Yeah. And you know, in most sports, even ones we really don't consider as sports, there can be dangers. Sadly, we have two very recent cases of the dark side of competitive eating. A 42-year-old man choked to death on April the 2nd at a voodoo donut shop in Denver as he accepted the store's Tex-Ass Challenge. That's T-E-X-A-S-S, Tex-Ass Challenge, to eat a half-pounder, that's the equivalent of six regular donuts, in 80 seconds. Now, later the same day in Fairfield, Connecticut, a 21-year-old college student died 3 days after collapsing, choking at a pancake-eating contest at the Sacred Heart University Student Center. Well, those two items are certainly food for thought. Yeah. Seth Lookhart knocked people out with intravenous drugs, prosecutors say. That's not the problem. The Anchorage, Alaska dentist is licensed to sedate patients. The problem, the state says, is he did it when it wasn't necessary and thereby billed Medicaid an unwarranted $1.8 million. He's also accused of performing extra procedures while he had patients under and of diverting money to his own LLC from the dental clinic he worked for. Oh, and extracting an unconscious patient's tooth on video while standing on a hoverboard. Wow. A dentist on a hoverboard. When it comes to all of his charges, that last one is like the cherry on top of an ice cream sundae. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, it's amazing what people will call art. Artist Lucy Gafford of Mobile, Alabama, has a flourishing audience of fans, exact numbers not revealed, but lacking a formal brick-and-mortar gallery show, she must exhibit her estimated 400 pieces online only. Gafford, who has long hair, periodically flings loose wet strands onto her shower wall and arranges them into designs which she photographs and posts at a rate of about one new creation a week since 2014. Well, that's hair-raising art. And by the way, how often does she clean her shower wall? That's what I'd like to know. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Stuart Nullman is back on with us, but it's not for a segment of book banter. You may remember a little while back when Stuart was last on that we mentioned that he was going on a trip with the BBYO, formerly known as the B'nai B'rith Youth Organization, for this year's March of the Living, which was an emotional trip for 2 weeks to Poland and Israel. Stuart is back now, so I thought we'd break from tradition and talk to Stuart about his trip and the meaning behind it. He joins us on the line right now. Hi, Stu.
Hey, Peter.
So you recently got back from this trip. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, the organization and what the March of the Living is, because it's an annual trip, correct?
That's correct. March of the Living is an international organization. It's based in the United States. There's a branch in Canada and around the world. I mean, I saw when we did the actual march itself from Auschwitz to Birkenau, there were delegations not only from the U.S. and Canada and different cities across both countries, but also there was India, there was Australia, New Zealand, there was Panama, there was Argentina, Brazil, Mexico. So it's a very international project in scope. But basically what it does, and it's mostly aimed at Jewish high school students, due to the fact, it started 29 years ago, and it's a 2-week trip. 1 week you spend in Poland, You tour the concentration camps. You also tour the way Jewish life in Poland was before the war. So you go to visit the Jewish district of Krakow, and also you visit Warsaw, you visit the synagogues. And it's highlighted on Yom HaShoah, where all these delegations march from Auschwitz, which was a concentration camp, to Birkenau, which was primarily a death camp. And it's not a far distance between the two. So then you have there's ceremonies, there's speeches. It's a very emotional type of event. But the main purpose is to keep the memory of the Holocaust alive, but the Jewish life in Poland before and during this terrible tragedy. Because, let's face it, a lot of the survivors, and we do have a lot of survivors come on the trip, and you go for years and years. A lot of them are, very old, in their 80s and 90s, and they're dying, and there's only very many left. So it's up to this generation of youngsters, of youth and young people, to continue their message, their legacy, to convey the message that the Holocaust happened and it should never happen again.
Now, how many students from the Montreal area went?
Well, I went with the BBYO delegation. They're based primarily out of the United States, and that was 140 right there.
Okay.
And there are delegations. There are delegations from Montreal, Toronto, primarily. Those are primarily Canadian delegations, and they're in the hundreds. They're in the hundreds. I mean, for this edition of the march that I went to, there was a total of 10,000 people.
And do the kids from the various backgrounds, I mean, they're all Jewish teenagers, but they're from various countries, various parts of the world. Do they get a chance to co-mingle with each other and not just share the experience with those whom they traveled with, but experience that with those making new friends at the same time?
Oh, yes. I mean, it goes from the point of departure on that first day. I mean, you're going to share a plane. I shared a Boeing 777 with not only our delegation, but delegates from Toronto, delegates from Miami, from California. Also, during the course of that 2 weeks when we're in Poland, I mean, yes, besides the actual march itself, some of you are staying in the same hotels. And also, when we're in Israel, you will... can encounter different members of the different delegations, and especially two major events. One is we do another march in Jerusalem from the city center to the Wailing Wall, and then there's a big mega event that it's almost like a show, like a tribute show. Beautiful, it was a spectacular show with entertainment and special performance numbers and tribute numbers. And it's called the mega event. It's something you would see, on European television kind of thing. It was really quite the thing. So yes, you do get to, co-mingle. There's many opportunities for different delegations to co-mingle, and they trade pins. And the Indian delegation were doing the little mark on the forehead for anyone who wanted to have it. So it was really quite the, the international. There's a true international scope to this event. There really is.
Now, going back to the leg of the trip where you were in Poland, mentioned in the introduction that it was an emotional trip. Walk us through how that felt for you. You had not been there before. You grew up here in Canada, so and certainly removed from the time of the Holocaust. You're obviously much younger than anybody who had been through that. Still, it's an emotional trek. What was it like for you being on that march?
Well, I'll tell you, Peter, I've since I was like 10, 12 years old, I read up a lot about the Holocaust, read a lot of books, seen a lot of documentaries, seen the photos, the film footage, and you know what? That doesn't prepare you for, when you see the concentration camps. And we visited four of them. Besides Auschwitz and Birkenau, we visited Majdanek, which was pretty well preserved after the Russians liberated it, and Treblinka, which was destroyed, and it's like almost like a graveyard, like a cemetery. But nothing prepares you, for what you're going to see up close and personal, up front. I mean, we visited the, the barracks. We saw the displays of the thousands and thousands of shoes and valises and clothing and human hair that was left behind by the many of the 6 million Jews who, you know, went to those camps, and very few came out alive. Also, we did go into the gas chambers. We did experience what it was like to go into those gas chambers. We saw, you know, the holes where the poison gas pellets were thrown down. We saw the scratch marks of those thousands and thousands of Jews that they crammed in there every time, struggling to get out. We saw the traces of blue on the walls that the Zyklon B left. So, you know, it's very harrowing to see that. You know, and you know the different cells and chambers that the Nazis used to, you know, psychologically and physically torture the inmates, and then whether it be Jewish inmates or political prisoners, communists, what have you, doesn't matter. And you saw that these vivid examples of how the Nazis, you know, basically took a human being and dehumanized them, you know, in many aspects, whether it be putting tattooing a number on their arm, to, you know, feeding them next to nothing, to putting them through, you know, brutal labor, you know, a lot of fear, a lot, you know, it's just incredible. I mean, you see, and also, you know, not only just men and women, but children too, you know, were victims. You see the photos, these, you know, ID photos of a lot of the children who went through Auschwitz, and you see the fear on their faces, knowing that, you know, that what the fate that's going to befall upon them, that they will not leave this camp alive. So it's really something. But Peter, the one thing that really personally struck me, and besides the march itself, and it's a great show of solidarity, is there's one room where it has a project called the Book of Names, and it's this massive, massive book that takes us a whole room, and it's basically, I don't know how it was done, but they compiled the names of all 6 million Jews, you know, by name, what town they came from in Europe, when they died, and how they died. So and it's very emotional to see people going through, rifling through this massive, massive book, and trying to locate some of their family there. Yeah. I decided to take a chance, and I went to see if any of my relatives on my mother's side of the family. I knew her maiden name, and I checked it, and just by a chance, because I thought that, you know, my relatives, you know, left Poland after the First World War, and they moved to Canada. And I looked, and I saw the name of the maiden name of my mother's family. It was spelled correctly the way it was. I remember it. I saw some from France and from Belgium, what have you. But when I saw the ones that I thought, you know, that were from the village and town in Poland that I knew they came from, and I saw a lot of them from those Polish towns and villages that I knew they came from, and that they did die in the Holocaust, that really hit me, and I had to leave. I was shaking. I was in tears, and I had to leave the place.
Wow.
I just couldn't bear it. It was this, you know, very eye-opening moment for me.
Well, we just have a minute. I just have another question I want to ask, and that is, you mentioned that, you know, that of course children were also part of this as well. You went there with a whole bunch of high schoolers, and you know what it's like to be a teenager. You think you're invincible. And that you're going to live forever. Yeah. Forever. What was it like when you saw the reaction of these kids when they realized that there are people who went through this oh so many years ago that were either their age or even younger?
Teenagers these days can be cynical and can be desensitized thanks to, you know, a lot of a healthy diet of you know, social media and technology. But, you know, I think it started, their emotions started coming out when we were in Auschwitz, when they saw the display of shoes and children's clothing and hair and personal effects, you know, that were taken away from them. And they were clinging to each other and they were hugging each other. And it was, you know, it shows that, you know what, that, you know, this is one of the vivid examples of, you know, that the Holocaust was for real, that, you know, it still is for real. And like I told you before, when I had that moment in the room with the Book of Names, one of the teens from the bus that I was staffing saw me like that, and she came up to me and comforted me. You know, it was, you know, it shows that, yes, we're there to help them. We're there to help them to comfort them. But you know what? When you need that, they're there for you too.
Amazing story, an amazing trip. And it's one that takes place every year, done by the BBYO. Stuart, I thank you very much for sharing a bit of the story with us, and we'll have you back on the program, of course, and under, as the saying goes, regularly scheduled programming. We'll have you back with Book Banter really soon. Thanks for doing this, Stuart.
Well, thank you, Peter. And like I said, we're here to continue the legacy and tell the story no matter how, no matter what. And I thank you for this opportunity.
Stuart Nelman, talking about his recent BBYO trip to Poland and Israel for this year's March of the Living. For more information, you can check out the BBYO's website at bbyo.org. You can also visit my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0403, and you'll find the link. And don't forget that you'll hear Stuart again real soon with our regularly scheduled segment. That is another edition of Book Banter. Tune in next week. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Think you're good at political trivia? Let's see if you can guess what famous political leader made this comment. Here's the quote. Regulators all too often encourage or approve unreasonably high prices, inadequate service, and anti-competitive behavior. The cost of this regulation is always passed on to the consumer, and that cost is astronomical. End of quote. If you're thinking Donald Trump, good guess, but it's wrong. Cutting government regulation is a popular topic these days, but that comment was made more than 30 years ago. Now that you know that, you may be thinking Ronald Reagan, but that's wrong too. Let's be fair, it's easy to think of one political party when we think of deregulation. But that statement was made by the former liberal U.S. Senator, Ted Kennedy. You see, in the 1970s, Kennedy led the effort to deregulate the airline industry. He lowered fares, revolutionized flying, and revealed the benefits of deregulation. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to the founder and proprietor of the Umbrella Cover Museum that's in Maine. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Be a patron of the show and find out about our rewards program. I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the Stuff File program and even some of your ideas for rewards. So come on, participate and join us for the ride. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram and be part of the Stuff File Nation. Well, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Residents of Placerville, California are fed up with potholes in the roads. One driver was given a ticket when his front license plate was knocked off by the rough road. Residents made their ire clear. They called attention to the problem in the roads with spray paint. They included messages like saying this is what they pay taxes for, and when that didn't work, painting phallic images by the potholes. Oh, that got their attention all right. Crews were quickly dispatched to remove the spray paint. They left without fixing the potholes. Well, you know, voters just need to quickly dispatch themselves to the polls and remove the officials. Problem solved. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Scott Dion, who has a sometimes contentious relationship with the Hill County, Montana tax office, complained in April that he had paid his property bill with a check, but, as before, had written a snarky message on the memo line. He told reporters that the treasurer had delayed cashing the check, potentially creating a late fee for Dion, apparently because Dion had written sexual favors on the memo line. Well, clearly, there is no room in bureaucracy for a sense of humor. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? If you were to travel to the state of Maine, one of the sites you could visit is the Umbrella Cover Museum. It's the work of a single Maine musician by the name of Nancy Three Hoffman. Nancy joins us on the line right now via Skype from Peaks Island in Maine. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Peter Anthony. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. I came across a story about your umbrella cover museum last year, and we first got in contact with you, but it was the end of your season. You only opened during the summer months, or between, Memorial Day and Labor Day. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
So you said, well, you know, get in contact with me the next year, and here we are the next year, so I thought I'd give you a call. I found this concept fascinating. How did the umbrella cover museum start?
It was from my own imagination, and I want people to be sure to understand that it's just the sleeves, just the pockets or cases of umbrellas, not the umbrellas or the big tops of umbrellas, just those little pockets that most people lose, forget about, or throw away. And when I realized I had a few collected in my house one day, I started asking other people if they didn't know what to do with their umbrella covers, basically. And they would say, oh, yeah, I have a few here in my house. Do you want them? And I inadvertently kind of collected them until I realized I had something. And the something I have is really the stories behind the covers. So I asked people to tell me, what happened to the umbrella? Where were you when you bought this? You know, give me some anecdote or some little history behind the cover. So they all have their own stories as well.
Wow. Now, how many, you started this, I believe, around 1996, right?
Right.
How many umbrella covers did you initially start off with, and how many do you have now?
Well, the first person I asked gave me two. So I added that to my own five. But, you know, I fairly quickly accumulated a lot. I mean, I had 35 or 40 when my first radio interview happened, and I thought that was a lot. Now I have 1,500 plus. And glad to say I do hold the world record, the Guinness World Record, for the most umbrella covers, which was 730 at the time we did the official count.
Wow.
So if anyone thinks of challenging me, I'm pretty well covered for any challenges.
Now, I'm assuming that with social media and news coverage, that one thing led to another and people are sending you umbrella covers. Would that be a correct assessment?
That is true. I got three this week, actually, in the mail. And I really, if people want to send me their umbrella covers, I would really ask them to write up a story to say, we found this in my Aunt Millie's closet, or, you know, just something about themselves or about the cover, where they got it, if it came from Austria or Canada or whatever. So that's part of the deal. And the mission of the museum, we state, is celebrating the mundane. So you can extrapolate that to other parts of your life and enjoy the little things as these are.
Absolutely. Now, you give tours at the Umbrella Cover Museum. First of all, you're open, I think, as you mentioned, from the beginning of Memorial Day till Labor Day, right? So it's just...
Right.
Yeah. It's coming
people
up
to... People need to check for the hours because it's really a little bit irregular, and we build up to like our full hours in July. So check on my website, umbrellacovermuseum.org, or give me a call or a text if you're thinking of coming to Maine to visit the museum. Yeah.
Now, in addition to the tours, you also, during the walkthrough, if I'm not mistaken, accompany the tours with a live accordion rendition of Let a Smile Be Your Umbrella. Is that correct?
That is our theme song, yes. And how many museums even have a theme song, I ask you. Plus, people will sing along because the words are posted and we have Shaker Eggs. It turns into a rather jolly experience going on a tour at the Umbrella Cover Museum. And hopefully by the end, people will have a big smile on their face, even if they come in with some doubts or concerns about the actual museum and its mission. Yeah.
How many people just happen upon your museum as opposed to those who make it a destination point? Like, do you get a lot of people saying, I was coming to Maine and I knew I had to come to the Umbrella Cover Museum?
More and more are actually finding it either through listening to interviews or on the web as a destination in Maine. But I'd say probably over half are still drop-ins. And you have to make an effort to get here. It's on an island, Peaks Island, which is right near Portland, Maine. So you have to take a ferry, 20-minute ferry ride over from Portland. Portland has loads of great things to do and see and fabulous restaurants. So, you know, you might as well make it a few-day trip. There are places to stay both in Portland and on the island, but you have to coordinate your schedule in order to get out here to see the museum.
Are you a native of the island? Was this always home to you, or did you come there on your own as well and just fell in love with the place?
Yeah, I did actually in one day fall in love with Peaks Island. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, or outside of Cleveland, and then traveled around, mostly the United States, but I love international travel as well. And then found this island, and I really do love islands, and this one in particular. So I've been here about 30 years. Mm. And also, in terms of my music, I'm in a couple of different groups. So I specialize in international folk music with my band, The Main Squeeze, which is an accordion ensemble, and also a group called the Casco Bay Tumblers, which is a klezmer band playing Jewish folk music and party music.
Oh, klezmer music. That's great stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
That's great stuff. Now, have you heard at all from, with the notoriety of your umbrella cover museum, have you heard at all from companies that make umbrellas or umbrella covers? Have you gotten any kind of sponsorship deals out of this?
No, but I think that's a great idea. And I particularly would like to encourage anyone that has that opportunity to get in touch with me, because we're going on a international tour. We're taking the Umbrella Cover Museum to Bristol, England in the fall. And so I want to build up, you know, some sponsorship and funding and so forth, plus a lot of press about our upcoming trip.
Well, wow. You know, places that rain, that's certainly a great place for the Umbrella Cover Museum to travel to. I would assume the other Portland might be a good place to go to as well, on the other side of the United States, places like Seattle and Vancouver as well, too, where it rains a lot. When one goes to a museum, you often have an opportunity to buy souvenirs. Are there any kind of souvenirs available at the Umbrella Cover Museum?
Yes, we do have a gift shop, and there are items that say Celebrate the Mundane or Umbrella Cover Museum. We've got bumper stickers, mugs, postcards, umbrellas, of course, a few of those, and, you know, other items that you can take home with you to remember your trip to Maine.
Now, when we talk about umbrella covers, we're not just talking the standard umbrella that one would use when out in the rain. You have umbrella covers for all kinds of umbrellas, including, I understand, if I'm not mistaken, like patio umbrellas and the like?
Absolutely. We have umbrella covers that go from 2.5 inches long, which is the Barbie doll umbrella cover, to a 6-foot or so patio umbrella, market umbrella. And I have some unusual ones that are like a collapsible telescoping umbrella cover that comes on an umbrella. I've got designer covers. I've got exhibits where you can play games like Mad for Plaid, where you guess which one comes from Scotland. I did have a political umbrella covers exhibit last year, which was our election year, of course. And one of my favorites was the Canadian umbrella cover, which came with an offer of citizenship in case the election went the way I did not want it to go, but I haven't taken advantage of that offer yet. We'll see.
That's amazing. In the years that you've had this Umbrella Cover Museum, I would assume you've become quite the authority on umbrella covers in general. Is there any kind of umbrella trivia that you can share with us?
Umbrella covers have been around since, I'd say, the 14th or 15th century. You can see them in ancient paintings from China and Japan. Those are the first obvious notices of covers. And then in 1750, there was a Frenchman who advertised that he had an umbrella with a cover on it. So the covers are not nearly as well researched as the umbrellas themselves, but that's what I know about the early history of the umbrella cover.
Well, if anybody wants to see something fascinating, this certainly would be it. The Umbrella Cover Museum. You mentioned the website, umbrellacovermuseum.org, correct?
That is correct. So please do get in touch with me so you won't be disappointed before you come out here to Peaks Island, Maine, to see one of the unique museums in the world, if I may brag.
And what are the times that the museum is open?
It tends to be open from 10 to 1 and 2 to 5, Tuesday through Saturday when it's in full swing. In June, it'll be more likely Thursday through Saturday, and then Sunday mornings as well.
Excellent. Nancy, thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Peter Anthony, thank you so much.
Nancy Three Hoffman from the Umbrella Cover Museum in Maine. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0403, and you'll find links to Nancy's site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Patrolling police in Albuquerque, New Mexico, got a tracking signal from a reported stolen vehicle. They found it parked at an apartment complex just as two men got into it and drove away. They followed them to the Metropolitan Courthouse. Sure enough, they parked and went inside. The driver, 20-year-old Alfonso Rodriguez, was coming in to get an ankle monitor, a condition of his release from jail a few days before. He was out on bail after allegedly stealing a different car at gunpoint. Police said it is frustrating having to use resources on the same offenders over and over and over again. Now, for the love of God, can anyone explain how someone who is going to the courthouse to have an ankle monitor installed because they've been caught previously stealing cars would drive to the courthouse in a stolen vehicle? Oh yeah, one reason, and one reason only. They're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0403. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0403. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WST. TJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were to play this episode backwards, any given this... Go ahead, try and figure that out.